This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Marine microbes include some of the oldest species on Earth. Over the course of billions of years, they've evolved to survive in some of the harshest environments on Earth. Microbes power ocean food chains in the nutrient-poor open ocean and around hot sulfurous hydrothermal vents. It turns out the systems that marine microbes have developed to cope with life in the ocean may also have applications in the treatment of human diseases. My guests today are conducting research that straddles marine microbial ecology and human biomedicine. Dr. Tracy Mincer is an assistant scientist in the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Dr. Max Saito is an associate scientist with tenure also in the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Mac, you've been collaborating with researchers at Johns Hopkins University and University of Texas for a few years to gain a better understanding of the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. Now, this is not a bacteria that lives in the ocean or has anything to do with the ocean. So just set the stage for us a little bit here. What is the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, and how did you figure out that there was any connection to your research on ocean microbes?
Sure. So the bacterium is known as Borrelia burgdorferi, and it is a spirochete that is, you know, you're right, it's not a marine microbe of any sort, but I'm in a community and a field that focuses on the role of metals in biology for nutritional purposes in the oceans in particular. A lot of the oceans are limited by iron, meaning that if you add iron, microbial communities will grow more quickly, in particular phytoplankton communities and cyanobacter communities. And so there's a real focus in oceanography on the influences of trace metals on nutrition of various microbial communities. And so in my group, we've been focusing on that for a long time, both through trying to measure the very, very low concentrations of metals in seawater. And then over the years, we've been trying to go inside the cells and figure out what those metals are being used for and what strategies life is using to cope with some of the very, very low quantities of metals available. And so through that, we've been developing a lot of tools to look at the proteins inside organisms and what metals are associated with them. This is something called proteomics, or more specifically, metalloproteomics. And those tools are actually quite sophisticated and quite unique. Over the years, we've been going to conferences. There have been efforts by my postdoc advisor at Princeton, Francis Morell, trying to bring together researchers from the inorganic chemistry community and the metals and biology community with some of the more environmental scientists to try and get us to sort of cross-fertilize and see what we could learn from each other. And through that, I was at a meeting. It was called the Center for Environmental Bioinorganic Chemistry. And I came across this scientist talking about Lyme disease and how it seemed to be a very unusual bug for metal use. And that, of course, immediately perked my attention because it sounded very similar to what we were seeing in the oceans. And I realized that we had a tool that could really potentially help one of the problems that they were working on. And that's when I approached her.
So what is unusual about metal use in the organism that causes Lyme disease?
So it's pretty fascinating. Borrelia is a microbe with a very small genome, and it appears to have evolved to not need iron at all in order to evade from the human immune system. So inside the human body, one of the ways that we fight infection is to really clamp down on the availability of metals, because all microbes, all life needs metals to survive. Just like we need, you know, nitrogen and phosphorus, we also need iron and zinc. And people hear about zinc supplements and iron supplements and things like that. All life needs metals to survive. You know, they're just an essential component of building the proteins you need to function. And what Borrelia has done is it looks like it's evolved to avoid any need for iron at all. And it really is basically one of the only organisms we know that can do this. And it's paid a lot of consequences to do so, but the advantage of that is it helps it evade the immune system to do so.
And so it turns out that this ability to not need iron at all may be one of the reasons that Lyme disease has been so difficult to treat, that it just kind of grows slowly and chronically without our body being able to fight it off.
Yes, perhaps. I think that it's a really interesting strategy. A lot of other microbes produce a lot of what are known as siderophores, iron-binding molecules that will go out and grab iron, and they're really in a sort of a warfare with the human body, which they're putting out these molecules that bind iron, and the human body is putting out proteins that bind those molecules that bind iron, and so there's this counter-warfare, and then they'll try and evolve a different structure. But Borrelia has taken the opposite approach. Instead of being you know, the hare trying to win the race with speed. They're the tortoise. They're going very slowly, and they're saying, we'll just give up on iron and evade those defenses.
So what do they use instead?
So that's what people had been focusing on. They looked through the genome, and they couldn't find any iron proteins except for one protein that they couldn't distinguish if it was an iron or a manganese protein. This is a superoxide dismutase, also known as a SOD. And it was hypothesized that it was probably a manganese form of the protein. But to actually prove that is actually pretty difficult. You have to purify the protein and see what metals inside it. But what happens when you purify a lot of proteins is the metals will fall out quite easily. And so it's hard to actually make that measurement. And that's something that we had been building here for a while, combining different techniques. And in doing so, we were able to, you know, we were able to actually make that measurement on purified protein extracts that we were sent from our colleagues in Johns Hopkins.
So talk a little bit about those tools that you had developed. I mean, as you said, they're very unique within the entire research community within the nation, not just within ocean science.
That's right. So it's a really exciting set of tools. So basically, we're doing a lot of proteomics measurements, which is the use of mass spectrometry to measure proteins inside microbes. But instead of just measuring one protein, we're measuring hundreds of proteins simultaneously, and we're measuring them quantitatively. And it's a very sophisticated and powerful tool that we've been developing so we can apply to the ocean, so we can sort of try and survey ocean ecosystem function or biogeochemical function. But one of the things we've been focusing on is trying to be able to purify a protein simultaneously with a metal attached to it. And that's, as I mentioned before, it's difficult to do. And so we had been adapting a method from some colleagues in the UK where they had gotten this purification scheme to go pretty far along. And then we were able to add our quantitative protein measurements with it. And we can very nicely start to see what metals are associated with which proteins based on when they elute from our chromatography and go into the two different mass spectrometers that are needed to make that measurement.
So talk a little bit about how this collaboration works. I mean, you said you're basically getting samples from the Lyme disease researchers. You aren't culturing Borrelia here or anything like that.
No.
But you're getting samples. You're doing your analysis, figuring out what the proteins are, what metals they're associated with.
Mm-hmm.
And then do you basically just send that information back to them and that's that? Or is there a further collaboration down the line in terms of this research?
It's been growing. We're actually, you know, the results were so exciting that my collaborators there have said, let's do more, let's do a larger study, let's try and look at more of the metallome, as it's called, all the metals within the cell and where they're going. And not only did we identify that there's this manganese superoxide dismutase and that, you know, that protein that we're not, you know, before we weren't sure if it was a manganese or an iron protein, now we're definitively showing that really it's only manganese and that if you give it iron, it doesn't seem to work. But we also came across another protein that looks like it's a manganese form. So something new came up in the process that was exciting to see. So there's more leads, and they brought in another collaborator from NIH to produce more material, and we're having another go at it in the next few months as well.
So how would knowing that Borrelia is using manganese instead of iron potentially lead to a treatment, or is this just something interesting that we're learning about this bug?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and it's a little early to know, but I think that the general strategy of trying to fight any disease is that you want to know what the disease is doing, how does the disease manifest itself, what are the attributes of it that make it unique and make it distinct from other human cells that you don't want to hurt, right? And the more you know about it and how specific it is, then the more tools or more possibilities you have to attack it, right? And so here's something that is very, very unique about Borrelia, and that gives us a way to say, well, we know it has these very unusual metal requirements. There must be ways we can start targeting those transporters, those proteins, or those systems in order to try and combat the disease.
Now, I'm curious whether there is, how much of a two-way street this is. You're obviously helping the Lyme disease researchers and research community immensely by helping to figure out this quandary. But does then this information or this research in any way feed back and help you in your attempts to understand ocean ecology?
You know, I think so. It's just a great additional example of the strategies that life uses to survive with metal scarcity. And, you know, each story we sort of stumble across is just really fascinating. And it makes you realize how much effort life has put into struggling with the starvation and the low availability of metals wherever they are, be it in our blood or be it in the surface of the ocean or in the deeps of the ocean.
So where do you think you have potential to be doing this in terms with other human diseases, or are there other projects like this on the horizon, or do you think this will kind of be a one-off where there was just by chance there happened to be a connection to Lyme disease?
Right. I hope that it's useful and that there'll be more possibilities. I know that we have another collaboration with our collaborators in the UK at where we're preparing to do some studies and on other pathogens. So, you know, but I'll we'll take that slowly, one step at a time. You know, we don't want to overcommit, and we want to make sure that what we're doing is worthwhile and is well done as well. So,
has this in any way, you know, kind of this focus and intense project on Lyme disease in any way detracted from your other research on ocean ecology, distracted you guys for a little while, and you kind of need to get back to that, or has it really broadened and kind of energized your lab, do you think?
No, I think it has energized the lab. I mean, I think it was, you know, because it's a relatively streamlined organism, and because they were able to send us semi-purified extracts, it was something we were able to take a method that we were just getting, it was just emerging from our lab, and use it and have a real success story very, very quickly. Whereas, you know, on some other samples, we were starting to see things and we hadn't put it together. And then because they're a biomedical group, they were just very efficient in getting the information out. So for us, it certainly took something that we were working on and got it out the door very quickly, which was satisfying for everybody.
You're listening to Living Lab on The Point. This morning, we're talking with HUI researchers who are applying their expertise in marine microbes and ecology to problems of human health. I've been speaking with Dr. Max Saito about his research on the organism that causes Lyme disease. We will continue our conversation and add Dr. Tracy Mincer and his research on cystic fibrosis after a short break.
Julia Trigg Crawford has known since last year that despite all her opposition, men were coming to her farm in Texas to bury a stretch of the Keystone XL pipeline.
Then things just suddenly accelerated. In the course of the last week, it went from a pasture that looked like everybody else's pasture and now looks like a disaster zone.
Coming up on The Story, challenging the oil and gas industry.
Join us for The Story tonight at 10 here on WCAI.
Another Science Minute.
I do enjoy going to sea. It's full immersion science. You're out there working 18-hour days.
Senior scientist Lauren Mullineaux at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
There are rituals that take place on the cruises. The recreation event for this cruise was a Jeopardy game where questions were given to a panel of three scientists and a panel of three crew members. Well, throughout most of the Jeopardy game, the crew was way ahead. And then the scientists started to catch up, and they were almost ready to take the lead. But the question was, what color was the ping pong table? And the scientists got it wrong. Then it came down to double Jeopardy at the very end, and the scientists got it right and won by a single point.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NBR stations.
The ping pong table is blue. It's not green.
This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Before the break, I was speaking with Dr. Max Saito, an oceanographer who's been studying parallels between the metabolic needs of marine microbes and those of the organism that causes Lyme disease. Also here in our Woods Hole studio is Dr. Tracy Mincer, assistant scientist in the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. In 2011, the Flatley Discovery Lab in Charlestown, Massachusetts, awarded Mincer $1.2 million to provide thousands of chemicals produced by marine microbes so they can be tested as potential drugs to treat cystic fibrosis. Now, Tracy, is there something specific about cystic fibrosis that made it an attractive problem to tackle, or is this just a problem that Flatley was trying to address and you seem to have the resources that might help them?
Yeah, sure. Microbes are they don't, under a microscope, they look very similar to one another. But where the true diversity is in their genomes and the chemistry that they make. They live their lives speaking to one another through chemistry. They are under constant pressure of being eaten, and they defend themselves with chemistry and so on. And it's been known for quite some time now that microbes can make antibiotics and other very clinically relevant type molecules. In fact, about 70% of all antibiotics were derived from or came directly from microbes. So the Flatley group came to us, and because they had a very special type of assay for screening for small molecules, and they needed feedstock. They needed stuff to screen, and they wanted to tap into the diversity that the ocean holds. And I was just really getting my lab started up in that area, and wanted to was looking for somebody to help me get that started. And so it was really a perfect merger in that way.
So why marine microbes? Why not soil bacteria or any other group of microbes to tap into?
Yeah, sure. Soil microbes have been explored for tens of years, many decades, and have yielded some very important drugs. But the ocean holds immense diversity and is, for the pharmaceutical companies, been difficult for them to explore. They don't just head out onto ships and go. That's what we do. And also, the ocean's hard to explore. And as oceanographers, we're experts in that. And in the oceans harbor immense diversity of microbes. And there's more microbes in the world's oceans than there are stars in the universe by many orders of magnitude.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So are there specific types of marine microbes that you're targeting? Are you targeting microbes from a specific environment or just bacteria, just plankton?
Sure.
Phytoplankton.
Right. So for many years in drug discovery, there's been a sort of microbial profiling, I guess. And there's been groups called actinomycetes that were of extreme utility early on. And Selman Waksman, who was a Nobel laureate for the discovery of streptomycin, but many other antibiotics, specialized in this group of microbes. And consulted with Merck and other pharma companies. And so they've been a favorite of the drug industry for many years. But it turns out that a lot of other things make antibiotics as well. And there's an ecological reason behind that. And they're communicating, they don't want to be eaten and other things. But it's also metabolically expensive. And so microbes that don't have to make certain special small molecules don't do it. They shed that. If they have a strategy, for example, they need to grow really fast, consume things very quickly, and then go into a resting state, typically they won't make a lot of what we might call interesting chemistry to us. But others that grow more slowly have to defend their colony against continuous grazing and such and can't swim away, and then they will set up shop for a long haul and defend their colony with chemistry, either attracting in their friends or repelling their enemies.
So how do you take advantage of that and actually gather those chemicals to be able to work with them in the lab further?
Yeah, sure. First, we explore and we look for little microenvironments that we think might be interesting for us. One of the things that we find particularly interesting right now is the surfaces of phytoplankton, which is, so these are little unicellular plants that live in the water column and are covered with other bacteria. And they really form true communities. Sometimes there's a real helping out of the microbes on the outside and the actual phytoplankton host. But it's kind of funny. It's, I see it right now as almost, like Downton Abbey in some ways, if you ever watch that, is that, who's running the show here? Is it the nobles that supposedly own the castle, or is it the kitchen help and the other servants and such that are behind the scenes doing other stuff? And so it's really a constant battle for nutrients and microbes on the surfaces fighting each other for in competitive interactions, but also the microbes on the surface bringing nutrients more making them more available to the phytoplankton host, but also quenching certain reactive oxygen species that can be toxic to the host. So there's a lot going on.
That is a lot. I mean, I'm familiar with Downton Abbey. I have to admit, I'm an addict of Downton Abbey. But who are the? I love this analogy. Who are the nobles in marine microbial ecology?
Yeah. First off, I feel like I'm revealing a bit too much about my TV watching, but it's fine. I suppose the nobles would be the phytoplankton. That's essentially who we're calling when we see a population of, let's say, E. huxleyi or certain diatoms that form these blooms. We say, oh, well, that's a Phaeodactylum bloom or something like that. But it's actually a lot more. There's a lot more going on than that. And so it's the ones that don't get named that are outnumbering the nobles.
So it's the most common ones or the most numerous ones, I guess, are the ones you're calling the nobles. And then there's a whole bunch of other ones that are present at lower abundances that would be the serfs and the peasants.
Yeah, it may be, but the serfs and the peasants, the epibionts, if you will, the guys living on the outside, outnumber. And so there's more of them than there are the actual nobles. And so the hosts.
Well, in terms of actually doing any lab work with these, I know one of the major challenges is that you have to actually be able to grow the organism that you want to study in the lab. And that's not possible for a huge array of ocean microbes, right?
Yeah, well, we believe that really if you can't culture it in the lab, you're just not doing the right thing. And some things for drug discovery, it's important that you have a certain biomass. You need things to be up in high amounts. And so we want to specialize in bugs that we know that we can get up to 10 to the 9th, a billion per milliliter. If we can in culture. And there's some things that probably they just aren't meant to grow in those kinds of densities. So right away, we're not focusing on those. But what's interesting, again, about the phytoplankton guys is that they do grow very well once we give them what they want. And one of the things they love to eat is methanol. And that was been a big finding in my lab. So
interesting. So you add a little bit of methanol to whatever your nutrient broth is to grow them. And that really
gives them exactly. A boost. Yeah, they love it.
Interesting. So once you actually do have these cultures grown in the lab, how do you then go about getting whatever chemicals they're making out and into a form that you can use for a biomedical assay?
Sure. So a culture's grown and will be a dense mixture of cells and medium. And the old way of doing things used to be just to throw in some organic solvents and mix it up and then let it separate, kind of a water and oil type phase separation, and then take that organic layer off and dry it down. What we do is a little more modern approach that gets a little wider range of molecules, and it's a plastic type resin that we throw in that absorbs all that stuff, all those other metabolites. And then we filter out that resin and elute that off in a small amount of organic solvents and then dry that down into what we call a crude extract.
But so then that's going to be a soup, really, of a whole bunch of chemicals, right? Everything that they've been producing.
Yeah, precisely. There's thousands of different things in there.
So is that what you go ahead and screen and figure if you get a positive result from that, you'll try to figure out what in that soup was actually the right thing?
Right. So many assays are robust enough to handle a crude mixture of this type of crude extract, and so we'll bring that up in a solvent called DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, which is a very good solvent and non-toxic to many different cells and specific types of assays. Other assays are more sensitive, so we'll fractionate or get them in a more pure form, and then provide that.
And so then that goes up to Charlestown to Flatley Lab, and they put that into some sort of assay to see whether or not it inhibits cystic fibrosis in some way.
Right. And so the assay that they have is it's a really nice breakthrough, I think, in treating cystic fibrosis. So just the problem in general is that cystic fibrosis is caused by a single variant or mutation in one protein that it acts like a pump on the surface of a cell. And it's called the cystic fibrosis conductance transmembrane regulator protein, CFTR. And this fits into the membrane and pumps chloride ions across. And a mutation there causes the pump not to work as well. But there's a whole range of mutations that can cause that pump to act in different ways. And there's already, in a very rare form of the mutation, there's a drug, a small molecule that can interact with that pump and make it pump to normal levels. And it's essentially a cure for the individuals that have that type of form of the disease. Over 70% of individuals with cystic fibrosis, though, have what's called the delta F508, and that's a missing amino acid at position 508 in the protein. And that creates a few different problems. Makes the protein, when it's made, the pump from the protein factory in the cell, the endoplasmic reticulum, makes it hang up there and not release properly. So these proteins have to be trafficked and chaperoned, if you will, to the right spot in the cell. But then once it gets out there, even if you solve that problem, this particular mutation pump doesn't pump at the right levels either. So it's got a couple of problems. And so the screen is to look for molecules that help traffic and get it off of that factory and positioned right in the cell, but also make it pump. And so it may be a problem where there's a couple of different molecules that work in tandem or as a cocktail. But right now we're looking in this screen, we'll see molecules that would probably do both.
So how's it going so far? I mean, it's been a couple of years that you guys have had this collaboration set up. Have you mm-hmm. found any great leads that seem to solve this problem?
Right. In the year and a half that we've been providing extracts, we've taken a more cautious approach, providing more purified type extracts, and it's been a lot more processing on our end. And we've gotten some interesting hits, but nothing that's really worth developing or following up on. So in the future, we're finding that in this next year and a half to 2 years left with our work, we're going to take a more high throughput approach and supply more crude extracts. And so we're looking in our lab right now what kind of instrumentation and automation, how we can provide 10,000 extracts in about a year.
That's a lot of extracts.
It is.
Does doing all of this help your lab and your research on basic ecology in any way?
Right. What this is going to do, it's going to provide first a resource of a lot of high quality crude extracts to be screened for chemical ecology studies in my lab, and provide resources for others at our institution and others who want to collaborate with me in the future. And that's very exciting. I like that a lot. But also, this work has already led to us thinking more deeply about these types of pumps. It's a broad class, one of the biggest classes of proteins known in all of life, called ABC transporters. And these are things that are on the cell surface that pump out or pump in stuff and are very important in a cell's functioning either as in the human body or out in the ocean to export toxins, to import nutrients. And we think that there's an important chemical ecology relevance to that in the oceans.
Now, this is not your first foray into the connection between marine microbes and human health. As a graduate student, you actually discovered a chemical produced by a marine bacterium that's actually now in clinical trials, correct, for multiple myeloma and skin cancer. So when did that connection first occur to you? How did that happen? You know, was it kind of an aha moment in the lab of I'm looking at something that could help cure diseases, or was that just kind of an evolving thing that mm-hmm. that gradually came about?
Yeah, sure. Some of the first field work I took part in when I was a graduate student, we were in the Bahamas and looking at – we had the idea that actinomycetes, again, these soil microbes that Selman Waksman worked with, could be truly adapted to the marine environment. And up until then, the question was that they form spores on land, and people argued that they're just spores washing into the soil and or into the sediments in the sea, and that's what you're cultivating, are just truly terrestrial things that have washed off. And so we were out in the middle of the ocean and collected sediments, and we saw these things come up that were brilliant orange colonies with black centers on them. And these were a type of actinomycete that were Micromonaspora types. And they're actually very important in the drug discovery industry. And so we thought, oh, well, that's interesting that these Micromonaspora things would be growing. And when I looked at them by using a genomic barcoding type method called 16S sequencing, we found that they weren't these Micromonaspora at all. They were a brand new genus. And they required seawater to live, which is a hallmark of a true marine adaptation. And what was really exciting is that I saw some fungus try to come in on a plate. Contaminants are pretty common out when you're out in the field. And you could see an area where there was just a zone of inhibition where that fungus was killed by the actual these new bugs that we called Selenospora. And I ended up making my dissertation around these bugs and isolated about 2,000 of them or so. And in-house in the lab I was working at, in Bill Fennekel's lab at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, we fed these into the cancer drug discovery program. And we got some very, very strong hits there and ended up discovering a molecule that we then patented.
You're listening to Living Lab on The Point. We're talking about research at the intersection of marine microbial ecology and human biomedicine. We invite you to join our conversation. 866-999-4626 is the number to call, or email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. We'll be back to take your calls and talk more after a short break.
Another Science Minute.
Going down in and out of volcanoes is a lot more dangerous than a lot of climbs are, because a volcano is a very dynamic environment. Of course, you have to worry about eruptions.
Ken Sims, associate scientist in the geology department at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
So the first thing you do when you go into the volcano is you try and assess the likelihood of activity and be monitoring that before and while you're in the volcano. But the other problem with the volcanoes is they're constantly collapsing. You know, you've sort of got a lot of very unstable slopes, and the new rocks are very glassy, so they're very sharp on the ropes. So we end up working a lot with the ropes to keep them from getting cut. You know, there's sulfur dioxide coming out of these volcanoes. There's carbon dioxide, hydrochloric acid, as well as lots of aerosols. You wear a filter gas mask. Of course, it's phenomenal. It's mesmerizing. It's like watching a fire. The lava lake in a volcano I've been to in Antarctica, Mount Erebus, is very viscous. Its lavas are real thick. They're thicker than honey, essentially. There, the bubbles take a while to rise to the surface, and they coalesce and form one big bubble. And then finally, when that bubble gets to the surface, it's like a big, loud explosion, a boom. They're beautiful and sort of awe-inspiring, too. Sometimes risks reap rewards.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.
Welcome back to Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests today are Dr. Max Saito and Dr. Tracy Mincer, both of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We're talking about the sometimes surprising intersection of marine microbial ecology and human health research. As always, we invite you to join our conversation. 866-999-4626 is our phone number. livinglabradio@wgbh.org is our email address, or you can find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Now, Tracy, we were talking just before the break about the fact that, you know, your interest in kind of the intersection of marine microbes and how the chemistries that they produce, the chemicals they produce for ecological reasons could have implications for human health problems. You've got an ongoing project now. You're also looking at trying to work on the problem of antibiotic resistance. What is it about this intersection that intrigues you so much?
Absolutely. It's first, I'm inspired by nature, and yet in biomedicine they have some of the most advanced tools many times. Although Mac is talking about where biomedicine doesn't have some of the tools that we have, which is always, which is not always the case for sure. I like to go to biomedicine. And in fact, if I go to a big conference, many times I won't even associate with my colleagues. I'll go to the biomedical conferences or the more biomedically driven things just to see where the cutting edge for them is and what they're doing. But in the case of antibiotic resistance, they have some great ways of screening these types of pumps, these ABC transporters. and it's something that I've always been very interested in to see if the basic question is, we know that microbes are making antibiotics, but I got thinking about this one time and realized that they must have run into antibiotic resistance problems, these antibiotic producing microbes, millions of years ago. Even with penicillin, I believe after a year when it was after its use, the first antibiotic resistance case came up. And so this is pretty common in the environment. You can see antibiotic resistance pop up, but microbes have been dealing with this issue and produce not just an antibiotic, but they produce a cocktail of other things to make their chemistry more effective. And one of the ways they do that, and we're finding at least, is that they're making these efflux pump blocking agents. So they're making so that these pumps act like bilge pumps in a cell that has antibiotic resistance. The antibiotic floats in pretty easily, but it has to be pumped out. And so they evolve these pumps just to kick it out right away, so it spends very little time in the cell and doesn't have time to have a toxic effect. But if you can block that pump and make it stay inside of a cell, then that toxic message stays and delivers.
So, Mac, what you're talking about, the tools that you've developed have, in this case, actually gone beyond what the biomedical realm has developed. But a lot of the research that you're talking about, the proteomics, the kind of sequencing that both of you are talking about in terms of getting genetic information about these, this is all stuff that came originally out of biomedical research. How much has that revolution in biomedical tools and biomedical science, the rise of genomics, changed what ecological research happens and how it happens?
Oh, I think it's been a huge impact. And I think, first I should say that the tools we're developing were very much leveraging what the biomedical community is producing. But, our focus on metals is actually relatively unique. So we're sort of adding and modifying and building on what's being developed there. I mean, the proteomic tools we're using are primarily being developed for cancer research, not for ocean research or anything else, really. But so we very much can leverage that. But, it's been, I think this, it's been a huge influence. Science is often very technologically driven, and whenever you can get access to new tools or new types of information streams, it can be very powerful. And I think with the genomic revolution, there's been a real just so much potential knowledge and then leverage that you can gain from having such a wealth of information about any given organism.
Now, HUI also, Owatonna Oceanographic Institution, has this microbial culture collection that is really just incredible collection of microbes, bacteria from unexplored environments, a lot of things that exist only in culture here in Woods Hole. How much of a resource is that? How critical has that been to your research?
Right. It's been terrific for my basic research in studying phytoplankton and also understanding better the epibionts, the other bugs that come along with some of these. Just talking with John Waterbury when I first arrived at Woods Hole, that's really what started it all for me. He was talking about a certain phytoplankton that he'd been working with for years called Trichodesmium, and said that as soon as he tries to purify them, they get very sick and many times will die. And I knew that there was something very specific and special about these epibionts, these friends that were actually helping the phytoplankton culture grow.
So, Mac, you've said that Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is really known for its submarines for going to sea, but that there are also some things about the institution that make it particularly well situated for this kind of cutting edge and crossing boundaries between fields, that kind of research. What is it about the oceanographic that makes it well suited for the kind of research you're doing?
Yeah, you know, it's not maybe as widely recognized because the submarine and the deep submergence capability we have at HUI is so impressive and is so appealing to the general audience out there. But HUI has a real capability for very technical work and sustained technical work, and that's unusual. A lot of universities have graduate students that are turning over quickly, but here at HUI we can have technical staff that are here for their careers and an institution that has a real focus on development. And so in our department, we have this legacy of really doing some impressive chemical development work through mass spectrometry and other methods, which a lot of our colleagues, I think, appreciate our capabilities here. And you know, I think it's true in what we're talking about here, too. You know, the ability to take mass spectrometry and what's coming, the latest developments in mass spectrometry, and push those capabilities out to the ocean to try and assess what microbes in the oceans are feeling or experiencing to understand global biogeochemical function is something that is sort of the pie in the sky dream that we've been chasing, and I think we're close to putting the pieces together to really be able to make it happen.
Developing new techniques, new technologies can be expensive, and in terms of whether or not it's going to work, it can be kind of a risky project to take on. And then you're talking about research that doesn't really fit into any one bin in terms of the topic of research. So how do you get this kind of research funded? Is that a challenge?
It is a challenge. To be honest, you can try and write a grant proposal to do development work, but it can often be hard to get funded, to be honest. And so a lot of times you have to do a little bit at a time on the side while you're doing other things that you are funded to do, and then try and get enough preliminary data to write the real proposal to say, you know, I'm going to try and do this. And, you know, and so, for example, our proteomic work, we were working on it for 7 years or so.
Just on the side.
On the side. And then it started to get some grants come in, and until we had enough pieces put together that we could really start to put data out. It was a very long haul, but it was really satisfying to be able to put it together.
And Tracy, I know you, with some of your ideas, have said you kind of had to shop around to find somebody who's interested. And in the end, what you've ended up doing is pairing up with a private biomedical lab, right? The Flatley Discovery Lab. Mm-hmm. So was that kind of the only place you could go to find the funding that you needed, was to this private source?
Well, I have to say we were very lucky because they started us out at a very early point, which can be a bit of a valley of death for young labs getting started. And so they've been terrific in that way. And now they're committed to the project. And I think we have a very, very productive and very healthy collaboration.
Well, and then you also have this interesting grant, an internal grant from the Oceanographic called an Ignition Grant. So what is that?
Yeah, sure. Well, what's great is that Woods Hole Oceanographic is seeing the benefit of generating more intellectual property, more ideas that have commercial capability, I guess. And so they want to foster that with this and with this Ignition grant. And it was about $50,000 with a 6-month time point. And they want you to pitch an idea or a product, something that's close to being intellectual property or an idea that could be licensed, and move it along. And that's what we were doing.
So is a patent essentially the next step? If you get a hit from one of these screens from these chemical extracts, is basically a patent is the goal?
Yeah, it is. And our So we have a screen set up for this these efflux pump blockers for antibiotic resistance that can be a problem in antibiotic resistance. And we've been screening, and we have about 20 hits that we're working up right now. And we already have one molecule that we believe we may patent. So in just a few months that we've been working on this, in our case, we think we could generate 3 or 4 patents at least.
Well, and a patent, if the patented item, chemical, you know, whatever, goes into widespread use, that in and of itself could be a major revenue stream. Is that revenue that would come back directly to your lab, or does that go to the institution as a whole? How does that work?
Right. Yes, patents can be enormously lucrative. And for example, there was a student that was part, when I was at University of California, San Diego, as a graduate student that was in on developing a luciferase reporter gene there. And that, I think to this day, that student gets a check for $250,000 every year. So they can. So typically what an institution will do is split the revenues with the inventor. For a while at the UCs, it was 50% split with the inventor, but I think they changed that to 30% now. Here at HUI, they're on that as well. It's about a third split with the inventor, and then a third to the department, and a third to the institution, I do believe.
I mean, that's got to be incredibly motivating and attractive, because, I mean, that would be the dream of any scientist, right? To be independently wealthy, essentially, to be able to pursue any scientific question you want to without having to write grants, without having to go through the whole funding process, which can take up so much time.
That's very true. And although one of the patents that I had, I got a check 1 year for 10 cents. So...
oh well, Mac. Is there anything in your you're not extracting a specific chemical? Mm-hmm. Is there anything in the work that you're doing with Lyme disease in terms of figuring out this unique use of proteins that could be patentable or licensable in some way?
You know, I think it's too early to say at this point for that. But we did have an experience a few years ago where we discovered a vitamin B12 binding protein from an algal species, a diatom. For the first time, and that was, you know, that was pretty exciting. That was the first time we'd ever seen any B12 uptake mechanism from an ocean microbe, and it had implications for algal biofuels. And so we did end up putting in a patent application for that. And
any 10-cent checks back from that patent
yet? It's still too early. But you know, I think that's one of the exciting things. And people often say that half of the genome of any organisms out there is relatively unknown in terms of its function. And and you know, this is a case where we found the function of one more protein, and so this is an organism that had 14,000 genes, and you know, just by that 50% rule, 7,000 are unknown of their function. We found one more of those functions, and that leaves 6,999 left to go in terms of figuring out what they do and what their potential applications may be.
You know, I think there's been a lot of discussion in the past few years about whether or not the Human Genome Project and the amount of money and effort that was put into sequencing the human genome, whether that effort was worth it and has borne the fruit that people hoped. You know, they said, oh, well, it's been so many years and we still don't have cures for all of our diseases. We still don't have all of these things that we thought we would get out of the human genome. And you're talking about, you know, 6,999 more. Are we just kind of on a fishing trip? Or is this, how really
question.
Important is it to really nail down the entire genome of these organisms?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. You know, I think that we need to step back a little bit and realize how fast the pace of science has gone. You know, I mean, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, there was no genome sequencing, or it was just beginning, right? Borrelia was one of the first organisms to have its genome sequenced. I think it was the third one in 1997, right? And here we are now where we're producing thousands of genomes a year, or not us, but, you know, people around the world are. You know, the advances have been very quick, but how do we then take that information and apply it and use it? And that actually can be much more difficult, because the characterization of what each one of those genes does when it becomes a protein can take an awful lot of work. And so we have a real need, like Tracy was talking about, for developing high throughput ways of characterizing what these things are doing, and that's going to be a bottleneck. So I think, you know, we have to realize we've made incredible developments, but still, it's going to be there's an awful lot left to do, especially as we start leveraging this genomic information, which is just the beginning. And for us, it's the tool we use to then interpret our proteomic data. We need that information to start looking at the spectra and figuring out what everything does.
How much do your two labs interact here in Woods Hole, talking about some of these shared challenges, shared themes? Obviously, the actual day-to-day in your labs, the techniques you're using are fairly different, but you do have these overarching connections. So how often do you get together and talk about that?
Well, we certainly talk over dinner sometimes and things like that. But, we haven't... We haven't done too much directly yet, but we've always thought, we should try and connect this and that, right?
I know. Yeah, exactly. I think, I don't know, maybe this will start us to talk more. But I really think that we're going to end up doing more together in the future, really.
Yeah, I mean, you were saying, Tracy, that you tend to go more to biomedical conferences even than to ecology or ocean science conferences, just because that's, I guess, kind of what excites you and where you get these ideas.
Right. So
are there any societies, associations, conferences that would really help you pull together, that do already try to pull together people that are trying to span these very different worlds of ocean ecology and human health?
That's a good idea. It's like a conference date. We could go off somewhere.
No, it's a great idea, and I don't know anything of a sort, really.
No, I think the reality is that both of us have been getting these, our respective setups going. And, I think in our case, we're just getting to the state where we're ready to really start capitalizing and leveraging it. And before, we sort of had our heads down, we were really trying to get the stuff working. And I think we're coming out of that now, now we're sort of ready for stepping back and saying, hey, let's connect stuff.
Well, I mean, and both of you have said a lot of the connections being made, those initial connections, those initial ideas have been rather fortuitous. Do you think it would be useful to try to manufacture essentially those connections, opportunities for those connections? Or is it always just going to be a matter of a fortuitous event to fertilize these unique ideas?
You can put I think it'd be a great idea to get disparate researchers all at a conference together and start talking.
Yeah, we have the same experience. We go to conferences a lot of times that are very biomedically related to learn about protein work. We'll be the only oceanographer group in the room, and out of hundreds of people, so it's a lot of fun.
Dr. Max Saito and Dr. Tracy Mincer, both of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks all for listening. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. You can find Living Lab Radio all week on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Michael and Roxanne Zack. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.